Five writers offer their personal reflections on King's life and legacy. Today we hear from the American writer Alice Walker. The recording's taken from a live keynote address she delivered at the Martin Luther King 18th Annual Memorial Convocation at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
Dead men love war. Dead men love war. They sit astride the icy bones of their murdered horses, grinning. They wind their pacemakers especially tight, and like Napoleon, favor green velvet dressing gowns on the battlefield. Dead men love war. They like to anticipate receptions and balls to which they will bring their loathsome daughters. They like to fantasize about the rare vintage of blood to be served and how much company they are going to have. Martin Luther King Jr. had asked us to do something really hard. Many people felt he'd ask us to do something impossible. He had asked us to embrace nonviolence as a way of life. When he died by the gun, for many, many people in the movement and out of it, there was a feeling of release. We can't do it, many felt. We can't live as nonviolently as Martin Luther King Jr. did. And the white man has once again demonstrated why. It was shocking to feel this. At the same time, it was completely understandable. I went through a period of being afflicted by horrible fantasies of blowing up terrorists, members of the Klan and the White Citizens' Councils, racist fanatics of all kinds who daily tormented and harassed us. And of course, blowing myself up right along with them, since as a pacifist and a deep believer in nonviolence, I could never fantasize murdering someone without also murdering myself. This was a particularly bleak and dreary dark night of the soul. And of course, our communities did erupt in violence. Several of them went up in flames. The youth especially could no longer bear to consider nonviolence as an option for changing the world. Guns flooded our neighborhoods, accompanied by the handiest painkiller, illegal drugs, because it was pain, all of it. The rage, the laughter, the feeling of being relieved of a burden too noble to bear. And underneath everything, the longing for the presence of the beloved, deeply, deeply, deeply missing him. The one who loved us and sought us and stayed with us, knowing he would not survive his blatant love for us, not survive his vibrant, dancing life. There was a rumor when I was at Spelman College, which is still right across the street from Morehouse, Martin Luther King Jr.'s alma mater. The rumor was that he was a terrific dancer. They didn't want us to know this, I think because he was a preacher. This makes it amusing that J. Edgar Hoover, as head of the FBI, audiotaped him doing more than dancing and apparently having an exhilarating time. I met him during that period of flying rumors. I was sent by my instructor in speech class to attend one of King's lectures and to write literally about how he spoke. We were warned to write nothing of his politics. Even though we students were risking arrest and getting arrested, eagerly listening to Martin's every word every day. After his talk, he shook hands with each of us. He had been brilliant, of course. But since I couldn't write about what he said, I wrote about what he wore. Really, really nice, neat gray suit. And I wrote about his accent, which I thought was pretty broad. Actually, pretty funny. Moving beyond belief, though, was the message of his speech. Because though impassioned, he didn't seem particularly attached to it. This was characteristic of him, I was to observe. His was a deep love for humanity. But it was wonderfully, wonderfully impersonal. Which is how we as Southerners felt. Martin Luther King Jr. was not the only one who thought he wouldn't survive. Most of us thought he would be taken from us sooner. And yet, when he was no longer with us, knowing we shared this awareness with him that he had known too, hardly made the loss of him easier to bear. He feared no man, he said. He had been to the mountaintop, seen the promised land. He might not get there with us, he said, but we as a people would someday get to the promised land. What did this mean? Americans, and African Americans especially, I think because we went for so long having nothing, can be very materialistic. There are those who believe that because we can eat anywhere, sleep anywhere, buy houses, and even airplanes almost anywhere, we have arrived at the promised land. Or, to be more accurate, they've arrived at the promised land. Because there is still the huge problem of homeless people, sick and out of work people, the continued drugging of our youth in communities across the nation, plus the 1.2 million African-American men stuck in prison. This is more the land promised by Bull Connor and George Wallace than the promised land seen by Martin Luther King. Here is a poem that speaks of the promised land I believe he saw. It's called Projection. To start, you must divulge not a secret, but a thing not commonly known, that at the back of each human's eyeballs, at the back of each human's eyeballs, resides the image of a little child. It is the world child, and it sits there gravely, looking out of our eyes, waiting for us to understand. So tell him this, first of all. Then when he says, those Indians are remote savages who do not deserve their own forest, tell him, all the children of the earth, all the children of the earth are perfect. When he says, those Germans and their ovens, tell him, like the clouds or grains of sand, all the children of the earth are perfect. When he says, those rotten Arabs and their women in bed sheets, You tell him, all the children of the earth, all the children of the earth are perfect. When he says those Chinese and their femicide, you say, like the feet of Jesus, the eyelashes of the Buddha, all the children of the earth, all the children of the earth are perfect. It is our life work to liberate across the planet the world child who always lives behind our eyeballs, imprisoned in the only image, our own, that we can sometimes see. The promised land that King saw was the country of freedom and justice. In his speeches, he says this many times. But how are we to get there? Remember, remember who we are. Remember who we are. We are a people for whom someone has died. We are a people who know what it means to have been seen, claimed, and beloved. We are a people who have always welcomed the stranger. Perhaps this is the most enduring definition of what it means to be indigenous, of what it means to be truly, truly, truly civilized. It has cost us. And yet, it is a surer path to the promised land of freedom and justice than is war. War, in any case, not only doesn't work, it is, in a world so easily destroyed by nuclear weapons, obsolete. Remember who we are, precious, radiant, seen, beloved. And if they say your self-regard and love of earth and humanity is unpatriotic and a threat to the fatherland, offer them this poem, Patriot. If you want to show your love for Americans, if you want to show your love for Americans, love Americans. Smile when you see one, flower-like, his turban rose pink. Rejoice at the eagle feather in a grandfather's braid. If a sister bus rider's hair is especially nappy, a miracle in itself, praise it. How can there be homeless in a land so crammed with houses and young children sold as sex snacks, causing our thoughts to flinch and snag? Love your country by loving Americans. Love Americans. Salute the soul and the body of who we spectacularly and sometimes pitifully are. Love us. Love us. We are the flag.
Tomorrow we continue our tribute to Martin Luther King when we hear from the Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman. Today's essay was written and read by Alice Walker, and it was produced by Emma Harding.
In Shop Talk today, we'll be asking why it is that the price